Welcome to the Bureau Briefing, a podcast by the Bureau of Digital, an organization devoted to giving digital professionals the support system they never had. Each episode, we're going to talk to a member of our community doing awesome, inspiring things. Now for your host, Carl Smith.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Bureau Briefing. It is Carl. And with me today, I have the president and CEO of Equity Impact Group and the founder and publisher of Abernathy, Mr. Willie Jackson. How's it going, Willie?
I'm doing so well, Carl. Thank you for having me today.
I appreciate you being on the show. And for people who don't know, Willie and I have known each other for quite a while. I think we met the first time in Atlanta at a web afternoon. I remember sitting there. And you were sitting a couple of seats down from me. And I was like, well, that guy's got it together. And then somebody came up and gave you a big bag of gummy bears. And I was like, what the hell?
Oh, that's like, so funny. I remember that phase of my life.
I was a speaker too. And I was like, why does Willie get gummy bears? But it was hilarious. And I remember I asked you about it and you said, yeah, people know that I like gummy bears. And I was just like, wow, that's amazing. So, Willie, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah.
And happy to unpack that story.
There you go. Well, for everybody listening, give them a little bit of background. Like, tell them who you are and what you're about.
Sure. I'm originally from Jacksonville, Florida, born and raised. I went to school in Tallahassee, and I'm a technologist by trade. So I started my career with a tiny company called Accenture. I was traveling 40 hours a month, living out of a suitcase, and not spending a whole lot and a lot of time in the house that I bought. And life was great until it wasn't. And I've been, I guess I'd say, jumping out of perfectly good airplanes for a living since then. So I started doing some freelance technology consulting, actually speaking and teaching and doing some other work right there in Atlanta. And, you know, opportunity came along for me to move to New York City to help launch a book publishing startup by a guy by the name of Seth Godin, along with Amazon.com. So I made books for 6 months, and I've done some fun adventure since then. I work in media now. I publish an online magazine for black men called Abernathy, and I'm having a lot of fun with that. And I relatively recently spun off a consulting arm because my perspective as a black man in America who has enjoyed a tremendous amount of opportunity and privilege, but also who's deeply connected to his own identity and very conscious of the disparities that exist in tech and beyond for folks who hold historically marginalized identities, gives me a really good lens into how to tackle some of these issues. It's thorny, it's uncomfortable sometimes, but it's an honor and a pleasure to sit at this intersection because I was socialized in a way that gives me empathy for all parties, except for, you know, terrible people who don't like gummy bears. But everybody else is fine. And so I'm a consultant, I'm a speaker, I facilitate workshops, I publish an online magazine, and I mostly see things in the world that aren't good enough, and I try to fix them.
So let's see, Seth Godin, Amazon, these names, they don't mean anything. So it's
sometimes,
like, I'm starting to wonder now if there's actually any credibility in having you here, but you know, we'll forge on.
It's just name drop salad.
Let's see if we can't figure it out. Well, now talk about Abernathy a little bit, because obviously I'm in Jacksonville. You were in Jacksonville for a while, and you were trying to figure out, you know, different things you could do for the city. Abernathy, this opportunity, I think this was an opportunity that kind of took you back to New York. If I'm wrong, correct me on that. But talk about that, because that feels like the love of your life right now.
Yeah, it's an expression of who I am, really. So I was I was raised in a way that shielded me from a lot of issues that historically affect black communities, unemployment, police violence, and so forth. I had a very unremarkable upbringing, in fact. And things came to a head for me in terms of how I viewed the world and myself in it and my place in it when Mike Brown got killed in Ferguson, Missouri.
Right.
And it wasn't just the senseless death itself and all the hoopla surrounding it. It was the way in which the media covered it. It was the backlash. It was the way in which my friendship circles, or my social graph, as it were, fractured along racial lines. And I saw some real ugliness just to spring forth from that social rupture. And I'd never really experienced that. And another another fascinating consequence of the timing was that, you know, citizen journalism played a huge role in that particular case, because normal people got in their cars and got in airplanes and went and live streamed the events there. And for the first time, a lot of people saw the disparity between the media narrative and what was actually taking place.
Right.
So I was, you know, my apartment in downtown Jacksonville every night, not day, watching, you know, provocation of protesters. I was watching tanks rolling down West Florissant. I was watching my countrymen being tear gassed.
Right.
And a lot of these issues I was following over Twitter. I was active on social media at the time, and I would see like protesters in Gaza telling people in Ferguson how to make gas masks out of household equipment. And it just changed me, man. It just changed me seeing that happen. And so I had to go I had to go inside myself and kind of understand what it is that I was dealing with, because in many ways I was oblivious to the realities, the very racial and racist realities of being a black person in the United States. And so I had to go to my history. I had to really understand the context for a lot of this ugliness that I was seeing, because I could no longer give things the benefit of the doubt. I really needed to understand the genesis of what I was seeing, and just as importantly, what I was feeling. It felt I felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I felt on some levels unsafe, because I realized, and the reality that came crashing down on me is that, regardless of my intention, regardless of who I was, regardless of how innocent I might have felt, and regardless of my accomplishments in life, the color of my skin dictates the fact that I am just one bad traffic stop away from losing my life. And it wasn't just a fear of my own safety. It was the realization that that is the reality for black people living in the United States right now. And that was really, really hard for me, because I don't, I haven't been raised in a way, and I haven't had experiences in a way that make me cynical,
right,
and in a way that make me feel like white people are terrible or out to get black people. That's not my lived experience. I've had a wonderful experiences and collisions and opportunities with people of all stripes. And so I had to make sense of it all, Carl. And that involved documentaries, that involved conversations, that involved it was deep. And I needed an outlet. I wanted an outlet that was productive for the expression of this discomfort, this rage, this anger, and making sense of the world. And what I specifically noticed was, in a new way, was the way in which black men were and are portrayed in the media, and it's shameful because the archetypes representing black men are that of athletes, entertainers, and criminal, very two-dimensional and predictable archetypes, and we are so much more than that. And so I wanted to create a place where we could celebrate the good news, where we could talk about our leaders and our heroes, where we could have some necessary conversations about the work that definitely needs to be done in black communities and in the world in general. And we wanted to portray more complex, sophisticated black male archetypes. And so we got on with it. And this coincided with the time that I was ready to do some other things. This is where, you know, I think the part of the story that you're aware of, I was doing some technology consulting. My work was online. I was frustrated. I was kind of bored, and I wanted to do something else. And so that coincided with the time of all these issues coming up with police violence and social justice. And I was ready to do something else. And I reached out to Seth. So for those of you who don't know, Seth Godin is the publisher of 18 best-selling books. He essentially invented commercial email marketing with a company called Yoyodyne about 30 years ago that he sold to Yahoo. And he's a daily blogger and speaker, a dear friend, a client, and an advisor of mine. And we worked together back in 2011 for this book publishing project that I told you about. And I reached out and I asked him if he had anything interesting going on that might benefit from my expertise, because we like working together. long story short, we got on the phone and we were in sync. I told him a little bit about what I was frustrated with and wanting to work on, which became Abernathy. And he told me about some of his projects. And he was like, great, when can you be here? And I was like, oh, I don't know, I'll probably be there in January. He's like, well, I'm not waiting. I was like, okay, I'll be there tomorrow. So I flew to New York the next day. So I came the next day and we talked about some details, some potential revenue models, some ways of working together. And long story short, he agreed to be the advisor for my thing, which became Abernathy Magazine. And he brought me on as in-house CTO. So I'm actually at his office right now. I spend a couple of days here a week. I live in Harlem, New York City, and he's got an office just north of New York City in Westchester. So, yeah, I don't even remember the question, but that's not my life. But I moved back to New York City to launch the magazine on almost 2 years ago exactly. And so I left New York. I left Jacksonville in a hurry. I remember I was really seeking what came next. I was definitely I understand now. I was creatively frustrated. I wanted an outlet. I wanted, you know, you caught wind of me thinking about purchasing a gym right there, yeah, in Jacksonville, and I needed an outlet for, I think, a lot of my skills and interests that hadn't been utilized with the pure technology consulting work that I was doing. So I'll pause there because I'm sure you have some separate questions, but there's a snapshot into how I got started on the current path.
And it was quick. Because I remember we were walking downtown, we were looking at this gym.
And then I disappeared.
I was sort of in the middle of not working, not knowing what I was doing either. And yeah, we were talking about it. And the next thing I knew, you were launching a magazine. You were in New York.
Yeah, I was Audi 5000.
Which, you know what? Good, because that gym space, you knew, I mean, as much potential as
there may have been, three thumbs down.
It was never going to work.
Well, it might have worked, but working in that context in that market
for
never
us,
would have, yeah, that would,
yeah,
have, would
for have, us, no, yeah. we got to be creating stuff. So Abernathy, so exactly. You launch Abernathy, and I have to say, I don't even want to call them articles. I mean, they're even more than stories. It's the what I've read in there, even as somebody who didn't grow up in your culture, in your skin, as somebody who grew up as a white guy, I read that and I feel like it expands me a little bit, you know, it grabs me and shakes me a little bit.
Yeah. The secret, is that the history of black folks in the United States is the history of America. And we've all done ourselves and each other a great disservice by not telling the truth about history. The reality is that black labor built this country. That's not debatable, right? But by not talking about the legacy of slavery and Reconstruction and the way in which it has affected and created the society that we all now enjoy, we've lost the opportunity to connect with each other over this rich, rich history that we share. And so as many revolutionary thinkers would say, like, our freedom is bound up in yours. Black freedom is tied together with white freedom. Like, you know, my grandparents were sharecroppers. Like, there is white blood in my system. Like, we are of the same thing. We are the same race. But we live in a context where we allow the media and these forces that continue to propagate through our society generationally to tell us a lie that we're divided in ways that we aren't actually divided. And so it doesn't surprise me at all, although I'm flattered and I really appreciate the feedback, that this stirs something within you, because there is a story that isn't being told that should. And it is a shared story. It is a shared experience. And that's why this magazine is important to me. And that's why I continue to do this work, and why it fills me with so much joy, because this is vital and necessary work that doesn't have enough of a precedent or a present in modern day media, because most of online media is driven by advertising sales. And we know that model is completely broken. And so it's what we frequently see is companies hemorrhaging cash in the race to the bottom. And that's the opposite of what we're doing. That's why you don't see ads on Abernathy. That's why I've taken time to create a reading experience that I think the audience we're looking to serve deserves. And we really care about the kind of stories that we're talking about, because these are long overdue messages and signals that we're putting out. So thank you for your feedback.
Oh, you're totally welcome. And you know, it's, I want to use the word uncomfortable, but that's not a good word, right?
It's like, it's a fine word.
It's almost like an awakening or a changing or growth, right? Growth can be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so take what you're doing there. And then we talk about, for example, you've got the Dev Boot Camp coming up. Mm-hmm. You've got things you're doing where you're taking this truth. I mean, I don't want to say narrative because that sounds like it's not the truth, but you're taking this into the technology realm as well. And I recently had Maya Patterson on the show, and Maya is a young woman, black Puerto Rican. And she struggled to get into the industry. I think everybody struggles to get into it because there's no on-ramp, right? You just kind of show up and you find somebody who has it, but she had extra layers of difficulty in finding her way. So I'm curious, when you go and talk with these groups, with these tech groups, what is your story? What are you sharing with them?
Sure. So this is it's such a great question, and it gets into the heart of my consulting and where I show up in this space. So my story is the story of a technologist, and I didn't have a hard time getting into tech. Success for me and many of my black friends in Jacksonville was almost a foregone conclusion. There is an internship organization. It's an organization called Inroads. Inroads.org is the website,
right,
that places historically disadvantaged youth in Fortune 500 internships. So beginning in 2005, when I was, I still had long hair. I looked very much like black Jacksonville, Florida. I was interning at Convergys Corporation downtown during the summers. And so over the summers, when I was taking my breaks from Florida State, I would be working full time in the corporate environment, understanding how that world works, gaining experience, going to workshops and traveling, and really seeing myself as the kind of person who had a career in corporate America. I realize now, with a lot of the sacrifices that my parents made in getting me into, you know, private school for preschool, because of course that's what kids need, and you know, private school again in middle school when I really needed that kind of structure, mm-hmm. They really saved my life in many ways. You know, Jacksonville is a fine place to be, but Jacksonville's rough in many parts, and the education system in many areas leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah.
And my parents had the foresight to do something about that. And it's important because I'm the grandson of sharecroppers. My grandfather had a sixth grade education. My father picked cotton in the segregated South. He's alive. He's 73 years old. He was educated in a one-room shack. When I was 22, I bought a five-bedroom house in the suburbs.
Right.
So in two generations, we see a remarkable amount of progress. And it matters a lot to me that even as I'm doing this work around equity and inclusion and social justice and racial justice and equality, that I recognize the degree to which I enjoy a tremendous amount of privilege as a tall, good-looking black male who is educated. Because what we're not dealing with is overt racism here. What we're dealing with is a lot of classism in the United States, the elephant in the room that we don't talk about. And I have a lot of social capital. I can pick up the phone and call folks who have money and influence and make some things happen. That skill is worth something. Me being in an environment where I had my resume reviewed regularly, and I knew to have the kind of email address that, like a lot of the things that we take for granted until you start mentoring young folks who have, you know, maybe a historically disadvantaged background, things that aren't so common. Those are the barriers that the young lady you're mentioning was likely coming up against. She did not, she might not have been socialized in a way that taught her the inside jokes and the secret handshakes, but I had those coming up. So I never operated from a place of needing something I felt like I didn't have already. And so I've enjoyed a wonderful career, and I've been able to quit jobs and walk away from opportunities and have my choice of jobs when I graduated in 2007, for example. And a lot of my friends missed the market. A lot of my friends of all stripes missed the market because they stayed behind to get their graduate degree, for example, and the market fell out. So, I mean, I was shopping resumes around for friends. Like one of my buddies, he stayed behind and got his master's at Florida State. Hmm. He had a ton of experience. He had a lot more experience than I did. And he was about to go into the Army. And the only reason that he didn't is because his mother had already lost a child. So like life is really, really real out here, Carl. Yeah. And I recognize now, in looking back over my career, that I am so privileged and so fortunate, which is a bit of a mind F. But that's a part of the beautiful, heartbreaking poetry that, you know, there's the experience of life. So I bring that into my conversation. So in tech, there's a lot of conversations about diversity and inclusion. And I hold my nose when talking about these things because the way that we're talking about them is deeply patronizing to a lot of folks. It doesn't actually work. Like, there's a reason that Google has spent $264 million over 2 years and has nothing to show for it. It's because we're starting the story in the middle. And there's a huge piece around African-American historical trauma. We can talk about that some other time, perhaps, around why these things aren't working. But what it really comes down to is trust and the legacy psychologically and emotionally and spiritually that American chattel slavery has had on African Americans. And so there are things that people are carrying invisibly that make many workplaces a challenging place to work. And many people are perpetuating behaviors that they're not conscious of, habits and adaptive behaviors that were appropriate for times of overt oppression, but not necessarily appropriate for modern day America. So it's complicated, but what I try to do is bring my story and the fact that I've had a wonderful career and the fact that I also represent an identity for folks who are having a dickens of a time breaking into this career or into this line of work. And there are a lot of reasons why this exists, but it's most important that we continue having a frank discussion around the challenge and the problem. And one of the only reasons that I sit on diversity panels is because I'm the only person who's going to be sitting there talking about slavery, racism, and discrimination. I don't know how else to have a conversation about why things are the way they are, because the real question to me isn't why are there more black people in tech. The real question to me is why we live in a society that reliably produces these disparities across industries. It's not like venture capital is like full of black folks. It's not like investment banking or law or medicine is full of black folks. So what we're dealing with is a national challenge. Diversity and inclusion in tech just happens to be one entry point that I'm using to have a broader conversation about the world in which we live.
So I've got two questions, and I think I can put them together. One is, okay, so I've been in the tech space for a long time, on the fringe of it, you know, digital agencies, web services, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. And my shop was never very diverse, right? I mean, Varick Rossetti's Filipino, that's as far as we got. It wasn't a thing. It was just friends. And obviously that is a whole part of the problem with diversity is when you're hiring people that you know, hiring people like you. But here's my question. When you're obviously educated beyond tech, you understand business, you obviously have taken the time to educate yourself and look across businesses. How is tech doing in terms of diversity compared to other sectors?
Pretty awful.
Yeah.
It's pretty awful. We're just talking about it more in tech. And
yeah,
that's the interesting story is why we're talking about it more in tech. I think a lot. Well, what is your understanding of the origin of this diversity and inclusion conversation in tech? Where do you think that stems from? What's your understanding? Not a trick question.
I mean, for me, it started out with speakers, like at events. Like that was where it first came to me, and it was that there weren't enough women speaking, and there weren't enough underrepresented groups speaking.
Right.
And that for me, because that was the world I was in. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as a white male who was speaking, I heard those conversations very loudly. Mm-hmm. And so that was the origin of it for me. And then it became to open my eyes into looking at the shops themselves.
Yep.
Right. So that would be how I came into it.
That makes perfect sense. So for a lot of folks in and outside of the industry, it was Google releasing their diversity numbers a couple years ago that started this longer and louder and sustained conversation about diversity and inclusion in tech. The reason they released their numbers is actually because of Jesse Jackson. So what he does through the Rainbow Push Coalition is he buys shares of publicly traded tech companies, and then he goes to the shareholders meetings and he says, "Where are the black people on our board?" It's the most gangster thing ever. And so that pressure is actually what resulted in Google filing what you call an EEO-1 report that releases the diversity numbers, and other tech companies followed suit. And so I'm thrilled to hear that you had a personal example of this, and you see that in through the speaker circuit, because that's just one of many ways in which these numbers are playing out. And because of the interconnectedness of our society, because of the way that social media has, the way that technology allows us to organize and grumble loudly and get a really visceral insight into, you know, what boards of directors look like, what a cohort of speakers looks like, people are getting frustrated because there is a lot of opportunity. We're seeing windfalls in tech and in companies, billion-dollar companies being birthed in dorm rooms. But these aren't black dorm rooms, right? These aren't the basements of Howard and Spelman. These are in, affluent right. communities, or communities that historically have not allowed or have not had many folks of historically disenfranchised identity. So I think a lot of it comes from frustration. And it's not just black folks. It's not just brown folks. It's also women. And, you know, we're living in a time when things are changing so rapidly. So we've lived in a time when we've seen, you've seen some of the, the struggle for black rights come to the fore in a way that I haven't, because, you know, I kind of took that for granted, that was given to me in many ways, the genesis of the modern day civil rights movement, if you will. Women's rights is, you know, something that a lot of us take for granted as well. But also getting into gay rights and trans rights, like the transgender mm-hmm. thing. I mean, this came out of nowhere for a lot of people. Like this is a full blooded thing. Poor North Carolina. It came out of nowhere. So we're seeing a shifting of society. And even with the election as well, what we're seeing is that huge swaths of our country feel overlooked, and they feel frustrated and pushed into the margins. And so they're speaking up loudly and voting accordingly. And the world is changing very, very quickly. And I will pause there, but that's how I'm viewing a lot of the changes that are taking place right now.
Well, I'm glad that you said the tech industry may be talking louder about it. Because that I think there's a comfort in thinking that it's being taken care of because you heard somebody say something. But the reality is nothing changes unless we change it. And that is everybody, right? I'm talking to the man in the mirror, Michael. It's like if we're not all doing something. And so that becomes also a frustration, because at the end of the day, you look at what you did to take care of yourself and your family, and you realize you may not have done everything you could have done
right.
to expand other things. And you get caught up in your own drama, and you forget about the bigger drama. And it's all excuses and it's all that crap, but it's like it's got to stay forefront. Another thing I want to hit on, and we'll just keep talking. I don't care. There's no time on this show. If people get to work, they can listen later. But you say equity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. You're the first person I've ever heard say that. I don't know that you're the only person saying it. There may be tons of people saying it, and I'm just not privy to it. What do you mean when you say equity inclusion, when the rest of us are just adding inclusion to diversity?
It's a great question. So diversity and inclusion are they're very different things. And one of the reasons I wanted to use specific language around equity is because we're not just talking about different colors, and we're not just talking about different races and checking boxes. The whole diversity and inclusion movement, if you will, came out of companies being tired of getting sued for $200 million for sexual harassment or workplace discrimination suits. Large companies kept getting taken to task for that. So this whole diversity and inclusion movement and concern has kind of joined with some of these social justice frustrations that typify some of the conversations that we're seeing in Silicon Valley. But a focus around equity and inclusion really has to do with leveling a playing field in a way that, to my way of thinking, involves an ongoing conversation. And it's not just having black folks represented here or white folks represented in certain ways. It really involves an ongoing conversation about what these terms actually mean in a very personal way. I think it's completely fine for places not to have black people. And maybe that seems controversial, but I don't think companies should feel harangued into having some diversity hiring. I think people should have a really honest conversation with themselves and the other leadership of their company at the kind of legacy they're looking to lead. But I don't think companies should be bullied or shamed for not having more black representation. I think it's fine. And the reason I say that is because a lot of these places don't have a lot of diverse representation because diverse folks don't want to be there.
Right.
So we talk about microaggressions, for example, and a lot of liberal white America rolls its eyes when we talk about microaggression, the tiny pinpricks of inequity and discrimination and annoyances, like, can I touch your hair? What's it like to be you? Just insensitive questions that span the gamut.
Right.
When you look at the interpersonal neurobiology of it, these actually register as pain in the body. And what that means is that for many historically marginalized people, many workplaces are actually violent. People are feeling pain when pushed into the margins. So when you look at a first-generation African-American who's going to work for a fancy company and they're dealing with people of different classes who come from perhaps moneyed backgrounds or even just different backgrounds that feel unfamiliar, and you've internalized all of these media narratives around not being worthy of that opportunity, or maybe your life doesn't matter as much, and you run on this on your internal operating system, and you feel like a fraud. The reality is that many black professionals in this company, in this country, feel like they're going to be found out at any moment. So it's this imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks are drowning in this. And so a lot of these environments, like, it's not hard to detect when somebody doesn't want you around. Like, there is a racial tension that exists in America that we're all aware of. We just don't talk about it. We've just come to accept it. And so we're all reacting to the same thing. And you know, organizations are like systems, and they naturally, they have a balancing effect. Some people will just kind of churn out if they're not a good fit for it. And they could be a bad fit based on a whole host of factors. But bringing it back to my work around equity and inclusion, I wanted to start a more thoughtful conversation around what it is that we are dealing with, because diversity involves, you know, more traditional ideas around diverse representation, people of different backgrounds, ethnicities, multiple genders, and so forth. Inclusion involves creating an environment where those people feel like they belong. And so this belonging piece is really what companies have to wrangle with, because
right.
Facebook hiring 200 black engineers today will solve precisely nothing about their challenges with inclusion. Because if those folks don't feel like they belong there, they will reliably churn out. It doesn't matter how much money you throw at recruiting. It doesn't matter what kind of campaigns you activate. You might get some people in your net, but if they don't have a home where you're bringing them, they're going to leave.
Well, and
that's like for anyone.
Yeah, and this gets I've had this conversation with a lot of owners around diversity and bringing in new people and how it just the culture wasn't a fit. Or these different things. And I'm like, the culture has to change. It can't be, culture's not a static thing.
That's right.
It ebbs and flows. And if you can't absorb some of that culture from new people, regardless of who they are, where they come from, right? It could be millennials. It could be an ethnic group.
Right.
It could be whatever. It's like, if they come in, their jokes have to become part of the culture, and
that's right.
Their food has to become part of the culture. Everything about them that makes them them, that makes them comfortable. It doesn't have to, everything doesn't have to flop. Everything doesn't have to switch, but
that's right.
It has to be able to absorb and to change a little. It's interesting. I heard the story. Lori Gold Patterson, who runs a shop called Pixo out of Urbana, Illinois, she said that she finally understood inclusion when everybody in her office started eating kale, because everybody was talking about how healthy kale was, right? And so she went to the office. She went to the supermarket and she got some kale, and it sat in her fridge and she didn't know how to use it. And within a couple of weeks, it went brown and she threw it out. And she said, "That's because I didn't know how to include it in my diet." And she goes, "And that's what nobody gets, is that it's not about buying it. It's about being able to use it. It's about being able to bring it into what you do." And she goes, "And so once I got some recipes and I understood about how to use it for salads or chips or this or that, suddenly kale was part of what I did. It was part of who I was." And that's what inclusion is. It's about understanding it's not enough to have it in the fridge, right? You've got to understand how to incorporate it.
Yeah, that's a great story. I'm so glad you shared. And that's a starting point for a conversation, right? Because there are Black folks who, like, there is a diversity of Blackness. Like, I have friends who come from extreme affluence, and they deal with a completely different set of challenges in reconciling their identity with their career and their story. I have friends who are interested in things that are completely uninteresting to me. People don't like hip hop music and like all the stereotypes. Like, these must be interrogated. But because we don't spend enough time talking about what identity is like, and, you know, acknowledging the, you know, what comprises the identity of Blackness, a lot of folks are just uncomfortable with the idea, because what we're defaulting to is stereotypes about an ethnic group represents and what they comprise. And so it's not enough to say that environments are simply racist. That's not simply what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. What we're dealing with is a lot of just plain ignorance, and I mean that in the literal sense of the word, and also a lack of familiarity, a lack of exposure. If you weren't socialized around Black folks, you're not really going to know what you're dealing with. That's not something we should shame people for, but it is something we should talk about.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, you used the word familiarity, and being familiar is a cornerstone of trust.
That's right.
Right?
That's exactly right.
Because if you're not familiar, then you question yourself. And then suddenly, if you're in that situation of not knowing what something is, then you get a little bit of fear involved, and suddenly it starts to fall apart.
Well, and one final piece with that, we live in a deeply ahistorical society. So I mentioned that my father picked cotton in the segregated South. Can you imagine the things that my father and grandfather have personally witnessed, experienced, and undergone as Black men in the United States? Like, can you imagine? And we're not so far removed from some horrible atrocities that have been perpetuated against Black folks. And, you know, we say with the same breath that, you know, things should be fine because we all have equal rights now. But, you know, most of the audiences I speak with have no idea that 32 years ago, the city of Philadelphia bombed a group of Black folks in an apartment complex, the MOVE bombing. They have no idea that there was a city in Florida called Rosewood where they had to bring in the armed guard because Black folks were hiding in the swamps because, white vigilantes came over and were literally burning it to the ground. Like, we don't live in a period of time that is so far removed from things looking very different in this country. And we are deeply invested as a nation in resolving a lot of that cognitive dissonance, because the reality is that America was built upon slavery, oppression, genocide, and murder. And that's uncomfortable for everyone to talk about. But because we haven't had a real conversation, not unlike, you know, West Germany, in public education around things that we don't do anymore, the lie perpetuates. And so we have to actively push back against it. Otherwise, you know, we will spend our time unwittingly wishing and hoping that things weren't as bad as they really are. And nothing changes.
Willie, thank you, man. I mean, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, and you have found where you're supposed to be.
Feels like it.
And I have no doubt that every group you talk to, every person that you meet, leaves change with their eyes a little more open. So thank you for being on the show today.
Much love to you, Carl. I appreciate you, brother.
All right, everybody. We will be back with another guest next week, and we'll talk to you then. Thanks for listening.